number 081174, John Woolard versus Robert Woolard. You may proceed, counsel. Mr. Foreman.
Good morning. It may please the court. I'm Brad Foreman on behalf of the appellant, Robert Woolard. Your Honors, this case is before you on the granting of a motion for summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff. There are several issues that we're asking the court to visit. One is whether the Illinois statute, the Trust and Trustees Act, allows a trustee to distribute to the parent of a minor beneficiary of a written trust, whether the trust in this case contained express language that overrode or was somehow in conflict with the statutory language. There's a secondary issue as to whether the monthly brokerage statements that were available to the lower court and to the beneficiary of the trust constitute an adequate accounting of the activity of this particular trust. We're asking this court to reverse this case and remand it for further proceedings. I will touch briefly on some critical facts without revisiting the entire factual history of the case. This case involves a trust that was created in 1983. It was created 1 year after the birth of the plaintiff, who was the beneficiary. That's Mr. John Woolard, who was born in 1982. It was created by his father, who passed away in July of 2002. He named my client, Robert, who was his brother, as the express trustee in the trust document. As is established by the record, the corpus of the trust was essentially kept in an account at a brokerage firm, Stifel Nicholas, which, as an aside, was a brokerage firm that my client and his brother had inherited from their parents. But for all intents and purposes, the trust corpus was kept in this account, and there were records of all the activity in and out of that particular trust account.
You know, coming across this case, one has the impression almost that this is sort of a sham trust. The purpose of the trust was to provide funds and assistance for the beneficiary's son, but the trustee states that he never inquired as to what any of the distributions were going to be applied to. Now, I can't imagine. That seems to me to be a complete departure from or ignoring the terms of the trust completely.
Well, we certainly, the word sham never came up, and I don't think anybody ever.
Well, I know it hasn't come up, but that's one of the impressions one gets when one reads the facts here.
I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that really begs the question that we're attempting to address by way of this appeal, which is in a situation like this where the distributions are made to the father of the minor beneficiary.
Well, what difference does that make, whether they're made to the father or to the custodian or whatever? Well, he didn't know what the money was going for.
Whether we knew or not, we're asking the lower court and we're asking this court to indulge in certain presumptions from the evidence, which we think they're entitled to.
Well, we can, I mean, the whole sham is certainly, I think, a pretty clear presumption. When the trust had over $850,000 in assets and it was down to $18,000 when the father died, so we're not talking about $1,000 here, $1,000 there to the father. We're talking huge sums of money for which there was no accounting, no explanation as to why that money was being used or how it was being used. It was supposed to be used for the son.
Well, we're talking about a period of 20 years, which
right.
We had submitted to the lower court was reasonable in terms of the lifestyle that was enjoyed by the plaintiff and his father, and that's where that whole issue comes into play. We think it's somewhat circumstantial, we admit, but given those facts, our presentation to the lower court and to this court suggested that that amount of money could be accounted for. And in fact, the plaintiff's father, as we learned at his death, really had no other assets. And yet the plaintiff was able to attend an Ivy League university with no financial aid.
Well, and so that part was probably properly used, but there was no accounting. Or Like, weren't some of the funds used to pay the father's taxes?
Well, there's some question about that, Your Honor, because the only record that suggests that are these promissory notes that turned up after the after Mr. Willard Sr. had died, John Sr. had died. And we argued, and I think the trial court actually agreed with us on that aspect of it, which was the notes that he created were at best a question of fact. One as to whether they were loans. And, in fact, the trial court expressly found that there was a disputed question of fact as to whether my client had knowingly made, quote-unquote, loans to the decedent. So as far as those notes being direct evidence of where the money went, that would be a question of fact, because those were documents that the decedent created.
Well, we can sit around and speculate where the money went, but the trustee never made any effort to determine where the money was going when he was paying it out.
Well, his testimony
means that he completely ignored the purposes of the trust, I think.
You know, his testimony, Your Honor, which is in the record, was that he had conversations with his brother, who was the settlor of the trust, from time to time regarding various needs. No question,
well,
that's a lesson.
We wonder whether this trust instrument is sort of a sham and they had another arrangement between themselves. I don't know.
And then you talked about this long period, over 20 years, but it is true, isn't it, that the trustee distributed over $300,000 in less than 1 year?
Well,
right?
We think...
And we don't know what that money was being spent on.
Walking around money, Si.
Well, we think the plaintiff was walking around with it, just as his father may have been, and that's one of our arguments.
But wouldn't you think there'd be some impulse to keep an accounting of that kind of money, or any kind of money if you're a trustee?
There's a less than perfect accounting here, no question about
there
it.
There is virtually no accounting
perfect,
at
right.
all.
You know, that...
Except to dump the money on the brother, who was specifically precluded from dipping into the trust funds by the terms of the trust itself.
Yeah, the trial court, in fact, that count one, which was the one... In the complaint that specifically sought an accounting was essentially dropped by the plaintiff because of the fact that we had all of the records that would ever exist in front of us and in front of the trial court, and those were the brokerage account records. So if someone wanted to know what
right,
dates that, money went out, what dates it went in.
Right, and that was sort of the trustee's sort of attitude. Well, the father had access to the account. He was on the account, and he had access to all the statements, and so the father could monitor the account activity, so the trustee thought his job was fulfilled. But so he didn't do anything.
You know, the overarching theme is at best, we would submit that there was some form of double-dipping going on by the plaintiff here, and that we believe that circumstantial evidence shows that he benefited from the assets of the trust. And that raises a question of fact. And so by penalizing the defendant trustee by making him replenish the entire corpus without any nod to the fact that the plaintiff may have attended college, may have gone on around-the-world vacations and golf lessons and enjoyed country club memberships.
The normal things of every American boy.
One would hope. This
the
plaintiff... Certainly.
You think we ought to offset whatever benefits he got from somebody or other against the liability on the trust? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In effect, we're suggesting there are questions of fact regarding the benefits that the plaintiff did receive, and the court is allowing him to, in essence, receive them twice. First, by all the benefits he enjoyed as a youth, and then again by attempting to recover him by way of a judgment against his uncle.
Interesting theory. Yeah.
You know what that harks to, Your Honor, is there, regardless of how you view this case, there's still, in any area of the law, has to be a nexus between causation, alleged wrongdoing, and damages suffered. And in fact, the complaint in this case specifically alleged, quote-unquote, is a direct and proximate result of the alleged acts of the defendant. The plaintiff had suffered damages. As a direct and proximate result of...
Let me ask a question following up on your theory and what Judge Cudahy asked. So was a specific breakdown provided for the court as to what things had been spent on the son? Where the son benefited?
There's no specific record in existence that I know of
and
a check to Colgate University, let's say, or a check to the country club or for the golf lessons. We do have, as Your Honor had mentioned earlier.
But let me go back. So that was not presented to the court, those specific documents that would have shown that certain things did go for the benefit of the son. So we don't have any of that in the record.
The only thing we do have, which Your Honor mentioned earlier, were these disputed promissory notes, which, again, had some notations made apparently by the decedent. And in some cases, there was a reference, I believe, to a payment for John's tuition, and there were two or three checks like that.
The father would be liable for the cost of education anyway, wouldn't he, regardless of the trust?
Well, he would be, and in fact, we made that point in our brief and to the lower court that...
You're in your rebuttal time, so as long as you just say yes, then it takes care of that, Mike.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Gorman?
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Claire Gorman, and I represent the plaintiff in this matter, John C. Wooler, who is the beneficiary of the irrevocable trust that forms the basis of this dispute. As an initial matter, I would like to address certain representations made by defendant's counsel, both in his brief and in oral argument here this morning.
Would you keep your voice up?
Yes, pardon me. Defendant's counsel asked this court to indulge certain presumptions regarding where the trust funds went and how they were applied. And in support of this, he makes general references to the lifestyle, quote-unquote, that was supposedly enjoyed by plaintiff's parents and, I suppose, residually by plaintiff himself. He suggests that plaintiff is essentially attempting to double-dip in a recovery.
He didn't just suggest it, he said it.
He did, Your Honor. I would agree with you on that. But the fact of the matter remains that defendant has not and cannot establish that any of these funds went to the benefit of plaintiff John Wooler. And the reason for that is, as defendant readily admits, that in disbursing over close to $900,000 of funds to his brothers, which we argue is an express violation of the terms of the trust agreement as well as his common law fiduciary duties under Illinois law. Defendant readily admits that in doing that, he never once inquired as to what the specific purpose of any of those funds would be used for. Judge Williams asked defendant's counsel if there was ever any sort of a breakdown or record provided by the defendant to the district court showing which of these funds they allege went to the plaintiff's benefit. And the answer is no, and I believe defendant's counsel said no. And the reason that no breakdown was ever provided was defendant's own breach of his duties under Illinois law and under the terms of the trust, not only to keep adequate records, not just that funds went in or out of the trust account, but what those funds went to and what they were used for. But additionally, and I believe Judge Cudahy recognized this, under the terms of the trust agreement, plaintiffs argue and Magistrate Judge Ashman agreed that the trust agreement expressly precludes the defendant from making any disbursements. We contend they were loans, and that was a disputed issue of fact, but regardless of that issue, any disbursements to plaintiff defendant's brother, John Wooler Sr., were precluded under the terms of the trust agreement. And in addition to that fact, and I believe that this is what was noted in defendant's argument, the trust agreement required that any disbursements that which were allowed to be made in the discretion of the trustee under the agreement had to be made for the exclusive benefit of the plaintiff. And in that regard, defendant breached his fiduciary duties and his duties under the express terms of the trust agreement in two respects. He dispersed funds to the father, which was expressly prohibited under the terms of the agreement, and above and beyond and separate from that, he never ensured that any of these funds went to the benefit of the plaintiff. The magistrate judge determined that summary judgment was warranted on three bases: on the express breach of the trust agreement, on defendant's breach of his duty to maintain complete and accurate records, which the magistrate judge agreed the brokerage statements did not constitute, they were insufficient. They only showed that checks were made, dispersed from the funds, but not ever what those funds were used for. And lastly, the magistrate judge determined that there was a breach of the common law fiduciary duties owed by the defendant as a trustee under Illinois law, and those are separate and independent from any duties imposed under the terms of the trust agreement. With regard to the promissory notes that defendant now asserts demonstrate or provide some evidence that some of these benefits went to plaintiff, it's significant to note that before the lower court, defendant specifically argued that these promissory notes could not be authenticated and had no probative value in determining where any of the funds were applied. I would note that plaintiffs in their briefing before the lower court on summary judgment pointed out the existence of these promissory notes and that in some instances the deceased appeared to provide some notation as to what these loans, which defendants dispute, what these loans were used for. And in two instances, there was a reference to a college counselor, I believe it was, and a tennis camp. I believe that the total of these checks for these two notations was somewhere around $2,000. I could be wrong about that. And it was a negligible amount. I will represent to the court it was a negligible amount in consideration of the fact that $900,000 was disbursed to plaintiff's father. So for this reason, Your Honor, we ask that you reject the argument asserted by the defendants that somehow plaintiff benefited from the trust. The entire argument places the burden on the plaintiff to come forward and show what he did or did not get from his father. And as a primary issue before even reaching that determination, the plaintiff owed no duty under the terms of the trust agreement. It was the defendant who had a duty to make disbursements solely, which comported with the terms of the trust agreement. It was defendant's duty to ensure that any disbursement made went to the direct and exclusive benefit of the plaintiff, not his father, not his mother, not his country club, the exclusive benefit of the plaintiff. And further, it was the defendant's responsibility to ensure that all records maintained by the trust would indicate where all of these funds came from. I think it's significant to note that in 1 6-month period, while the plaintiff was a teenager attending public high school, the defendant disbursed to his brother, who defendant asserts was financially irresponsible, lived beyond his means, and was in substantial debt. The defendant, in 1 6-month period, disbursed $300,000 to his brother. In one of those months, it was a disbursement of $145,000. Defendant has come before the district court and come before the court today and admitted he cannot account for a single penny of where that money went to. And he asked this court to place a burden on the plaintiffs to come forward and demonstrate that he didn't get any of it. Well, we don't believe that that burden belongs to the plaintiff, but regardless, plaintiff can't do that because there is no record anywhere. As defendant readily admits, there is no record where these payments went. No one knows. What we do know is at the time that the plaintiff's father died, he was entirely insolvent, and the trust account was virtually depleted. And from that trust, plaintiff received a negligible amount. And we believe that as the trustee, and given the flagrant breaches of his duty, defendant is required and liable for all of those amounts. I'd also just like to add that under Illinois law, in conjunction with the trustee's duty to maintain complete and accurate records of all trust activity, the rule of law is that to the extent that the trustee fails to meet that duty or breaches that duty, any disparities or obscurities will be resolved against the trustee. In this case, the trustee has asked this court to resolve any disparities or obscurities against the plaintiff without providing any mathematical breakdown or any other evidence whatsoever that any funds went to the plaintiff. It asked this court to presume and indulge in presumptions regarding a lifestyle enjoyed by the Woolard family. We argue that there is no basis for this court to do that. We additionally argue that under Illinois law, a trustee is held to a duty of the utmost good faith and fair dealing and fidelity. As the court in Meinhard versus Salmon stated, it is with a punctilio of an honor most sensitive that a trustee is required to act under Illinois law. In indiscriminately disbursing nearly $900,000 of assets to his brother, in violation of the trust agreement, in violation of his fiduciary duties, Robert Woolard fell well short of meeting this standard, and for these reasons, we ask this court to affirm the decision of Magistrate Judge Ashman granting summary judgment to plaintiff on counts 1 and 2 of his complaint. If the court has no questions.
We have no questions. Thank you, Ms. Gorman. Mr. Foreman, how much time?
4 minutes. Thank you, Your Honors. In going through the record, I find at least one check, which is for $16,000 and specifically was noted as JC's Colgate tuition, written in 2000. I think that was the year that the plaintiff entered college. That's a little more than a negligible amount, and I could find maybe a couple other examples of these types of payments. Agreed, we did dispute the authenticity and usefulness of these documents, but they are in the record, and we do think they create questions of fact, because after all is said and done, this is still a summary judgment case. I mean, that's how it was decided. So when I mention these presumptions, it's not in an effort to make light of the situation or make light of the evidence, but to simply remind the court that if there are any presumptions, they should be indulged in the favor of the defendant against whom the judgment was entered in this particular case. And we think the presumptions that we're asking this court to indulge in are fair and reasonable from the evidence. If the money didn't to pay for the college and the lifestyle issues that we've raised didn't come from the trust.
Was that $16,000 payment to Colgate by the trustee?
Well, what it is as with all the payments, is a alleged promissory note.
Well, what I want to know, is there a check payable to Colgate by the trustee from the trust?
That is not in the record, Your Honor.
Well, where did the $16,000 come from?
Well, what the $16,000 is a supposed record of a distribution made from the trust to the decedent. Mm-hmm. And the reason that he took that distribution.
But there's no payment from the trustee to the Colgate. All it goes to the father.
Right, it all goes
and
to the father.
And then you're assuming that the father used that $16,000 to pay to Colgate.
We are presuming that from his own notation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But not from anything from Colgate.
Mm-hmm. Not from anything from Colgate.
Okay.
No. And that $16,000 would be what under would be about 2% of the $900,000. You said there were a few other checks that had notation. So it's certainly a minimal amount.
And, of course, we can't ask the court to accept these notations as gospel.
Of course, the father wasn't supposed to be paying. The trustee was supposed to use the money for the benefit of the trust, mm-hmm. of the son. I think if you really want to analyze it, is the old man trying to protect the son from himself.
Well, one of our...
And to that extent, he put the trust, had his brother take it, and he says, don't give me any money, give it to my, take care of my son. But to presume, for us to presume then that the old man took the money given to him by your client and delivered it for the son's benefit is a long stretch, isn't it?
Well, a little more than a presumption, Your Honor. We've pointed out that the Illinois statute, in fact, allows distribution to be made to the parent.
Assuming that there's accounting that was done through that. That is, the father said, I want the dough to pay for the kid. But there's nothing in that light that I saw, is there?
Well, we've also pointed out that another portion of the same Illinois statute refers to an accounting that could be provided to the parent.
Maybe kind of a shock the all the way around, but I'm not unfamiliar with the Illinois statute.
Certainly not, Your Honor.
Or trust agreements.
In fact, that gets into the other question of whether the trust somehow was in conflict with or overrode the statutory language which permitted expressly distribution to be made to the father in this case. The trial court said it did. We have pointed out in our brief that the section that everybody's talking about that provides for distribution uses the word may, not shall. It provides that it may be distributed in certain methods, and we would suggest that that's not intended to override the Illinois statute.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Foreman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your fine oral argument. We'll take the case under advisement.